Now, in those days, the days of charming Anna and Simeon, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus, sending battalions into the peaceful streets of the region. So begins the story in Luke 2. In the larger context, about 40 years before those days, 47 BC, just linger with me this morning in the BC-AD transition. About 40 years before those days, before Anna and Simeon, Julius Caesar and Cleopatra had a charming little boy. They named him Caesarion, meaning little Caesar. 3 years later, 44 BC, Julius Caesar was assassinated. And Octavian, the adopted son and heir of Julius Caesar, succeeded him to become Caesar Augustus, Caesar the highest one, so named by the Senate. The Roman Caesars had a thing about any child, boy or girl or adult, in the line of succession to be king or emperor. So it is not surprising that Herod, according to Matthew's gospel, was disturbed when people from the Orient came to Palestine. They came from the Orient, came to Palestine asking, "Where is he that is born king of the Jews?" What is important about this story is that the birth of Jesus was considered to be so extraordinary that people came all the way from India and Persia to hear about it. There were claims that Caesarion should succeed Julius Caesar. So Caesar Augustus eliminated Caesarion, as was customary by Roman emperors, after subduing Antony and Cleopatra. This is all context for Anna and Simeon. In case you think I have made all this up, see Stacy Schiff, her book entitled Cleopatra. It is spellbinding. Today's story is only one scene on Luke's theatrical stage, chapters 1-3. It is Elizabeth and Zechariah, the Annunciation, Mary's Magnificat, the birth of Jesus, angels and shepherds, Simeon and Anna, Jesus in the temple at age 12, and oh my. According to the Times, much later, John the Baptist was beheaded by Herod's order. I told you that the Caesars had a thing about anybody who aspired to be a king. That included Jesus, not only on the day of his birth, but through his lifetime. I wonder if the Roman world was on Simeon's mind when he turned to Mary in the temple and said, "You know what, Mary? This child is destined for the rising and the falling of many. It's pretty ominous. And Mary, a sword will pass through your soul too." So what do Simeon and Anna do? This is their opportunity for imagination in the temple. Imagination around the rituals of cleansing and naming, purification and circumcision. Rather gross rituals. But instead of reciting the Ten Commandments or the traditional Jewish prayer, Simeon, inspired by the Holy Spirit, imagines salvation for everybody and a light to the Gentiles. Now, temple priests had little interest in being a light for Gentiles. They were avoiding Gentiles. Well, out of that bit of perspective, I will offer a few comments about my own advancing years. Until this morning, when we heard a lot about this stage of life, I was under the mistaken impression that nobody had noticed my advancing years. It helps me get up in the morning if I think nobody has noticed. Just a few comments. I imagine congregations and denominations in which the rituals of naming and cleansing, liturgy and sacrament are occasions for mediation of God's salvation. Congregations and denominations in which a traditional ritual leads into an imagined future and not just preservation of a treasured past. Ritual in faith and church is occasion for world-changing imagination, my personal world and my public world, yours too. A bit more background. For the last 30 years, I've been a student of historical contextual theology. We all need a little bit of academic exposure, so stay with me. What I mean by historical contextual theology is that we get meaning from the text that is shaped by the living cultural and political environment around the text, Caesar Augustus, and also the neighboring texts. Going back to the first verse, in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus. That is the neighboring text for all that follows. I think that contextual theology is important because in it we discover the first century Jesus movement. Now, in my spiritual and theological journey, I would like to commit to the first century Jesus movement rather than to creeds, rather than to the Nicene Creed or to the Mennonite Confession of Faith. Jesus movement theology integrates personal and public ethics with our God relationship. Taking a cue from Simeon and Anna, perhaps imagination is a way to push through the changing years, may I add, and not spend so much time on the past. There is still much to learn, like a discovery I made this week anew, that baking powder expired in 2016 doesn't work well in 2018. That once happened to Gwen, too. That's where I learned it, to do it that way. I'm a very ordinary person who's had an extraordinary life. In my life work, I've been present in and interacted with the sacred passages of hundreds of people and their communities. Most of you don't know that in my first career, which included studies in international affairs, I had more than a decade of negotiating development projects with village leaders and governments in four different countries of the Middle East, followed by ministries for justice and peace with Mennonite World Conference and MCC. In my second career as pastor and counselor, I was gifted with the learning process of hundreds of people in their formation, reformation, and transformation, just as we all are engaged in that kind of momentum. You can read about it all in my spellbinding memoir that's in the library. So I will not tarry on that, in that mode. Tarry is also a word that ministers used long ago. We are all in the process of leaving, arriving, and moving on. In the last 5 years, I have visited Philadelphia many times, particularly the Philadelphia Symphony, Washington, D.C. Where else have I been? New York City and Boston. We live here right next to the East Coast metropolitan area with a great many resources that draw us out from our inwardness. Well, just a few summary comments. The first century Jesus movement is a source of my spirituality, I would like to think, a source of my spirituality and theology that spoke out in so many different directions, including a fresh discovery of great music, as I have just mentioned, sitting behind and up close to the Philadelphia Orchestra. The Jesus movement that I embrace does not include the guilt-producing legacy of St. Augustine, just in case my focus on Jesus this morning awakens some of the more pathological overtones of traditional religion. Finally, Jesus movement imagination bleeds into ethics for public life and politics, integral to my spirituality and relationships. My imagination has turned me into an advocate for the common good, emphasizing equality against inequality. I conclude with two quotes. The first by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, the youngest woman ever elected to the incoming Congress. She said recently, "Tragedy and sorrow in my life is intertwined with unspeakable joy and gladness." Actually, this is my quote. We're going to get to Alexandria's in a minute. My concluding comment is, "Tragedy and sorrow in my life is intertwined with unspeakable joy and gladness, all mixed together like a bowl of spaghetti. Finding joy in Bach's Christmas Oratorio while grieving over the suffering of the world and the distress in this country as well." And now for Alexandria. "In the wealthiest nation in the history of the world, our greatest scarcity is not a lack of resources, but the absence of political courage and moral imagination." As I listened to Bach's Christmas Oratorio this year, I noticed the next to the last selection. The soprano anguishes, "Oh, when will the time be ripe?" The tenor answers, "Oh, when will the comfort of his people come?" And the alto interrupts, "He is surely already here." And then the soprano and the tenor go into a never-ending Bach duet. "Oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus. Come then to me."